Hello. I know you're expecting that funkalicious beat of an intro I have, but I decided to do an intro today for our podcast guest because we have professional golfer Steve Surrey, who's from England and now plays mainly on the Sunshine Tour down in South Africa. Steve is very knowledgeable, great to chat to, and good crack as always. So he talks about his career, the highs, the lows, and his views on the golfing world as they are now with the power-obsessed nature of it. And he also gives a nice tidbit of some great advice that he had on the 18th hole of his maiden win in South Africa. Steve's audio quality isn't fantastic. It's not bad, but it's not fantastic just because he's in a hotel lobby in Dubai. So if you can stick with it and get through that, then it is worth it because he's fantastic to chat to. As I said, very knowledgeable. So stick with it. Enjoy the podcast. I'll bring the beat in now in a few seconds. But make sure to support Steve. Follow him on the South African tour, the Sunshine Tour. He's one of the good guys, so enjoy the podcast, and I'll chat to you soon. And I'm very lucky to be joined now by Steve Surrey, professional golfer. Steve, thank you very much for joining us. How are you?
I cannot complain. I'm lucky enough to be away at the minute, so yeah.
Yeah, Steve joined the Zoom, and it was just sunshine, and like it just looked incredibly beautiful. Steve's currently in Dubai. Was it kind of a to go over and practice, Steve? Was that the main reason?
Yeah, I was originally supposed to come here for sort of around 10 days practice and then go to South Africa to play the Sunshine Tour out in South Africa. And then they postponed the event by a month. So I was a bit stuck between going back home, staying here, or... because obviously Dubai is not very cheap, really. So sort of 5 weeks here, it would have been quite expensive. But I got sort of a bit lucky and met some guys that I've played golf with and stuff. So most of my golf's been covered, etc. So that brings the cost down a lot. So yeah, it's made a week's trip and then feel like I'm wasting money by going home to then sit at home and not do anything. Which sort of would have been a bit of a waste of money paying to come out here and practice. But it's ended up turning into a good trip, so I've got quite a lot done.
Yeah, definitely going back to the UK and not having any, you know, you wouldn't be able to play, so
no, that was a good decision. It's a bit productive, to say the least.
Yeah, exactly. And what is the situation like in Dubai currently? Are you pretty much free to roam?
There's been a few more restrictions. I think when I first come, restaurants and stuff are like, I think it's like 80%, and now they were down to 50% occupancy. But yeah, you can go and play golf and stuff like that. And I think they've got quite a lot of people vaccinated here. I know I got a bit of stick with sort of the Instagram crowd and stuff being out here. So that sort of, I don't know, made you feel a bit bad about being out here, if you know what I mean. So it's like I've actually got a genuine reason.
Yeah,
one of the few places I can play golf, I can practice. The weather's good.
In fairness to you, Steve, I follow you on Instagram and I haven't seen one picture of you on a camel. So I think you're okay.
It'd have to be a strong camel.
Yeah, Instagram models tend to be on camels, so I think you're okay. We'll let that one slide.
Thanks, mate. Thank you.
You mentioned already you play mainly in South Africa in the Sunshine Tour. You've been on that since, I think, fully since 2011. Has it been around then, Steve?
Yeah, that's about right, yeah.
2011, yeah. How did that move come about? Because I know you did play in Europe mostly at the start, and then obviously you went to the Sunshine Tour. And how did that move come about?
I was having to play sort of Jamaica, Euro Pro and stuff for a few years, then play Challenge Tour for a couple of years. And then one year, I didn't get through stage one of European Q School. A friend through a friend at the time sort of said, why don't you come to South Africa and do Sunshine Q School, because he played the tour as well. So I sort of went and did it and got a card, and originally I probably played sort of 8 or 9 events per year originally for the first 2 or 3 years, whereas I'd say over like the last 5 years I've been playing sort of 18 to 25 events out in South Africa, so it's sort of become a second home over the years. Whereas originally it was a place to sort of go to do a bit of winter's practice and play some tournaments, really. Whereas now it's my main focus is probably playing on sort of one Sunshine Tour now, and then use the summers back home just to play a few events and keep things ticking over, really.
And how is adapting to that move? Because obviously it's a big move to switch from the UK to South Africa, and in so many reasons, obviously weather is one massive part, but golf courses are very different, I'm sure. Like, so how was that first year or two? Was it a struggle?
Yeah, I struggled a little bit because the grass is quite different. They have like Kikuyu grass, which the ball reacts totally differently on. Like when you're chipping, sort of most European grass, the ball will pop up quite high without much spin, whereas Kikuyu grass, the ball comes out really low with a load of spin. So you've got to change the short game quite a lot. And we play quite a lot in Johannesburg, which is at altitude. So the ball sort of travels 10% further, which is great. But when you come from a October, November in the UK, where the ball's probably going 10% shorter, suddenly you're hitting it 15 to 20% further. So visually, it's just quite tough to look at it and be like, I've got to hit a six iron from here, where I've actually been hitting a hybrid back home. So that takes a bit getting used to. And it's a slightly different style of golf with predominantly better weather, lower scoring, compared to most of the golf in the UK, for instance. It's generally not very good weather. Try and nudge it round and sort of keep control of your golf ball, whereas Sunshine Tour is a lot more try and hit it as far as you can, a lot of the lads, because it's good weather, long golf courses, generally a bit wider, sort of soft. So, yeah, it's a slightly different game.
And so that's a good point, because I watched a couple of videos and you were saying that about the Sunshine Tour. And is that something that you struggled with to adjust? Did you adjust your game to be more of a long hitter, or was it just you kept your original game?
Yeah, no, I'm sort of, I had it pretty short. So I'm probably in the shortest 20 players on Sunshine Tour. I'm trying to get a little bit longer, but I was quite a long way behind to start anyway. Sort of in Europe, I'd be one of the shorter hitters, and the South Africans generally hit it quite long anyway. So yeah, I've tried to hit it a bit longer, but I just rely on trying to think my way around a bit better and trying to be a bit more consistent than maybe some of the other guys, partly because I don't have the skill set to hit it sort of 300 yards.
If anyone's seen you play, it's incredible how consistent you are. It's like, so your driver is like a laser sometimes. It's actually, it's scary to watch in that sense, because someone who doesn't hit the ball that straight, it's very intimidating to see that. But I was going to ask this question later on, but it's a good time to ask it now. The golf game seems to have become, or the golf world has seemed to become, obsessed with distance. So, like you say, you're trying to get a bit longer. How important is it to you now to add length, or are you happy enough with what your game is now?
No, I mean, I need to add length. So my, for anyone that understands like ball speed and stuff, I'd be like 160 ball speed, 108 club head speed. So I need to try and get that to like 165, 170, which would still be on the lower end of the spectrum on tour.
DeChambeau is over 200, yeah, isn't he, in the ball speed?
Yeah, and there's a few guys on Sunshine Tour that can get sort of James Dupree. I think he got sort of 208 when we did a video with James Wiltshire on YouTube.
I've seen that.
But I'm never going to get anywhere near those lengths. So it's, I want to get longer, but I need to maintain my accuracy, because I wouldn't be getting long enough to offset my accuracy by the extra distance gains, if that makes sense. If I could go to 180 ball speed, then I wouldn't really be so fussed about my accuracy, because I'd be in the middle to higher end of tour speeds. But because I'm so far behind, I'm not going to get to that level. So I need to slowly creep up the distance, but maintain sort of a bit of accuracy and stuff.
Do you think the golf world has become too obsessed with the power side of things and the speed side of things?
A little bit. I think a bit of course design and a little bit of, say, like the technology is so good, both in equipment and sort of TrackMan and flight scopes and GC quads, get you to be able to optimize what you do, the biomechanics side of it, everything. And also the maths, like the stats, you can simply show if you drive it exactly the same and just move your ball 10 yards forward, you know, you'll save 0.6 of a shot around or whatever it may be. So it's, and it's also a consistent game. You know, if you can hit the golf ball at 190 miles an hour, you can do that every day. Whereas you can be the best putter in the world, but you get a few bobbles and you lip out and suddenly you're, you know, you might putt badly for a month, whereas ball speed is the one thing that you can maintain. No matter how you're playing, you will maintain a high ball speed Whereas putting, you know, sitting, say, like a Ricky Fowler this year is not putting very well, was generally he's the best putter on tour, and Jordan Spieth has had his putting issues after being the best putter. Whereas, say, Bubba Watson, he's still, irrespective of what he does, he will still be one of the longest drivers. Bryson now sort of will still be one of the longest drivers. It's a skill set you don't lose. It's not sort of a form-related skill set. It's something you carry on with you.
Yeah, exactly. And what's your view on, like, Bryson DeChambeau? Because he's such a polarizing figure in the world of golf. And I think, personally, it's not that I like him. Sometimes I can think he can be a bit of a, you know, a bit obnoxious, whatever that. But I think he's great for the game. Like, he changes it up in a game that can be known for being quite traditional, if that makes sense. But what's your opinion on him?
Yeah, no, I mean, what he does with his golf, I absolutely love, to be honest. He looks at basically the pure numbers and sort of, if I do this, then I will get better. Whereas I think golf's probably one of the few sports where you can kill a good career by trying to get better. Like, trying to change your coach, change your caddy, change equipment, improve your technique, or work really hard on one area of your game that was a weakness, and then you lose the areas of the game that were good. I mean, it's happened to a lot of good players where they've lost their game. So it's quite risky what Bryson did, chasing the distance, the extremes he has, because it could seriously backfire on him if he did lose his game, which I think most people look at it and think, yeah, it happened very quickly, and as I might, it's so hard to put on distance, let alone a lot of distance like he has done. So yeah, I thought it was quite a ballsy move, really.
The easy part is the eating. That's pretty
easy
to do.
Yeah, and no, I can cope with that.
Yeah, I'm happy. I'm probably eating similar calories to what DeChambeau is every day. It's just the other side of it that I'm not doing.
That's all right. At least you're trying. You've got one bit.
Yeah, exactly. So you said you're trying to add a bit of speed. Can you tell us what that actually involves? So a lot of us amateur golfers, we hear about players trying to add swing speed, but we don't actually know what goes into it. I know it's probably a lot of gym work and other stuff, but so what are you doing personally to try and add that speed?
Yeah, I've been working. I'm quite lucky. One of the friends at the golf club, Adam Shuckle, he's sort of a very clued up personal trainer that's done a lot of stuff with sort of quite specific sports. So I've been working with him for like probably the last 6 or 7 months in the gym, trying to do not golf specific, but just like speed specific stuff. And then like use the speed sticks and try and do a lot of jumping, because it's sort of a rough formula that basically how high you can jump, how far you can jump, and how far you can throw a ball sort of has quite a strong correlation to what sort of club head speeds and stuff you can generate. So yeah, it's not golf specific for me, but it's like speed specific, rather than, I suppose, just lifting weights without really having a plan of implementing that into more speed.
We'll go back to the Sunshine Tour. You got your maiden win at the Vodacom Origins Golf Final in the Sunshine Tour. Tell us a little bit about that. Obviously, watching the highlights, the conditions looked incredible. It was, you know, sunny, basically on a cliff, it looked like. So conditions obviously were very windy. How do you like those conditions? Do you think that suits your game, more windy, or would you prefer the pristine conditions?
No, I don't like playing in the wind, but I'm generally quite good at playing in the wind. If it's windy, I don't relish it, but I know, well, I'll probably do better than quite a lot of the other lads. And it was really windy that week. So yeah, previously on the windy events, I've done all right on the Sunshine Tour. And yeah, I never forget it, because I think through three holes, I was struggling on the greens. I three putted two of the first three greens, or three of the first four greens. And I was like, oh, this is not going well. Like, probably going to struggle to make the cut here. And then just sort of grinded away and got around an okay score. And it was windy again the next day and I had a good round. And it was sort of funny from, there's only a 3-day tournament. So from a few holes in thinking, oh, I'm going to miss the cut here. Like, what am I doing? Moaning to then winning by, I think I won by 3 or 4 in the end.
I think you won by 4. Yeah.
Yeah, no, generally the wind and stuff, I sort of cope with it quite well. And I think it sort of suits my game. I tend to have quite a lot of control over the ball rather than I'm quite comfortable hitting it low and shaping it against the wind. Whereas when you get to Johannesburg, some of the courses I really struggle because I can't fly the bunkers at 270. And 65% of the field can fly those bunkers comfortably. So then you're at quite a big disadvantage. So the windy, more linksy courses tend to suit me.
And is that something you've worked on, or have you just become naturally good at it?
Yeah, I think as a kid, I just used to basically mess around a lot. We were always, I was quite lucky at Camberwell, there's like a bunch of good golfers all at the same age. So when we were like 13, 14, 15, we'd all be playing 36 holes a day, trying to, you know, play a hole with a 6-iron, next hole, like doing, at the time you think it's stupid fun stuff, but you actually learn quite a big skill set in terms of shaping the ball, controlling the ball, you know, hitting, trying to hit a 6-iron from 130 because it's the only club you've got, and so all stuff like that, which at the time was fun, but long term, I think that's where you learn your sort of control. Sort of a bit like when you go to the range, like have a bit of fun, you know, trying to hit the 50-yard marker with a 2-iron or something. Is that actually a shot you play when it's blowing 30 miles an hour? That's a useful shot to have. That's sort of, I don't know, I think that's where it came from, was, yeah, messing around as a youngster.
And you, that final round of that tournament, I think even the front nine, you were possibly 3 or 4 over that front nine, or you were definitely struggling on the front nine compared to the back nine, where I think you went 3 or 4 under to shoot par. How tough is that mentally to not let that round slip away from you? Because I know 99% of amateurs, if they bogey the first few holes, the rest of the round isn't going to go very well. You know what I mean? They're going to let it capitulate, and it's going to just build up error after error. But that you didn't do that day, and that was in a pressurized situation. So can you talk us through how you recovered that round?
Yeah, I mean, generally, I try and view it that, I mean, that was a bit extreme because the weather was terrible, but in a normal round of golf, I'll probably have between 3 and 5 birdies. So, like, if I have a bad start, I try not to panic because I feel like I've got 3 or 5 birdies sort of in the bank. It's just, you know, and say I'll average 2 to 3 bogeys around or whatever it may be. It's like, right, they've just all come early. That's all that's happened. So it's like not a reason to panic too much. Like, just hang in there and trust that long term you will make your birdies to counteract. I remember that day, we all struggled a bit on the front nine because it was proper pumping. So it sort of helped that I didn't think anyone would be able to shoot 4 or 5 under for 9 holes and leapfrog you because you've had a bad run. The back nine, I just remember playing quite solid golf, and Jack Blau, who was in the last group, hit a bad tee shot on 16, I think. And I think, like, I might have been tied or one ahead of him, but I think he made 6 and I made birdie, or he might have made 7. So suddenly I was 5 ahead with 2 to play. I always remember one of the scorers, I walked off like the 17th, and he was, oh, well done. I was like, what do you mean, well done? He's like, as long as you don't make 10 down here, you'll win this. And I was like, great, thanks, mate.
That's not what you want to hear.
How am I not making 10? How can I make a 9?
Yeah, I was a par 3 as well. That was impressive. I want to touch on a point you said there. So the group wasn't playing well, and that sort of helped you calm down a bit. On the other side of things, when you're trying to shoot a low score and your group isn't playing well, does that impact you?
I think you have a bit of, like, I've played with guys where, say if I don't feel I'm playing very well, but they're playing really well, I think that's where they sort of drag you up a little bit, if you know what I mean, because you might scuff it round a little bit in 3 or 4 under because your playing partner's 6 or 7 under. One's 6 under and the other guy's a few over, then you do feel a bit alienated sometimes. But then I also think sometimes you don't even notice what score you're on, whereas, or you feel totally comfortable being 6 or 7 under through 14 holes, and then the next round, for whatever reason, you might only be 2 or 3 under through 12 holes, but you get a bit nervous. But it's also realising, because you feel a bit nervous, it doesn't really impact on how you can play. You know, I see it all the time with amateurs. You know, I play the medals back home with some of the lads, and, you know, through 15 holes, they're going great. And it's like something switches in their head, or they get a bit nervous, and suddenly they think they're going to play bad golf because they're a bit nervous, or they start trying to play defensively or they start panicking. Was it like, in reality, the golf ball doesn't really know you're nervous, or it's like, you can play good golf when you're nervous. So just sort of get out your own way a little bit.
Okay, yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, because I totally agree. We've all been there as amateurs where you're on for a really good score 15 holes in and then it just falls apart. And it's just because you think that is it making it more important than it actually is? Like, this is just a bit of fun with your mates, whereas professionals are actually playing for, you know, money and titles. Why do you think that is? Is it because we're watching these players play in big tournaments and we're sort of putting ourselves in their shoes nearly?
Yeah, I think that's a good thing with golf, is that everyone's in the same boat, if you know what I mean. Someone trying to break 90 for the first time, someone trying to break par, someone trying to win a monthly medal, someone trying to win a club champs, someone trying to win the Euro Pro, a challenge tour, a European tour event. It's sort of all, it's a similar form of nervousness, you know, right? The end stakes might be slightly different, but I think that's why golf is quite relatable to people of all different levels, because you all experience the same sort of feelings and nervousness and the uncomfortable things of being on the golf course. Whereas I think, yeah, amateurs tend to, I don't know, for me, if I'm doing well, I try and think in a year's time, I won't even remember this. So like, it doesn't really mean, although it does mean a lot, try and take off the emphasis of what it does mean. Whereas I think amateurs start, you know, if you're doing well through 13 holes, you've got the 14th coming up, I don't like that hole, but then 15's an easy hole, 16 I normally do all right, 17 I get a shot up 18. So you're still on the 12th hole, but you're like, your mind's racing ahead trying to think of what, trying to make stuff up of what you could do. So we'll just concentrate on what you're doing right now and keep doing that till you run out of holes, really.
You said after the winning that tournament, that was great for the opportunities that it brought. That's good English, isn't it? The opportunities that came with winning that tournament, such as entry to, you know, bigger tournaments, and I think the South Africa Open was the following week. Are you aware of that going into that final round? Like, are you thinking of that, or are you just trying to block that out completely?
Yeah, trying to block it out, but I mean, that's sort of the main reason you try and win sort of the smaller events on the Sunshine Tour, is to get exemptions, to get into the co-sanctions. So it just makes life a lot easier then. And then once you're in the co-sanctions, sort of, which is like co-sanctions with the European Tour, sorry. So if you're in those and you play okay, it's a lot easier to then maintain that ranking, because the prize money is so different in the sort of 3 to 5 co-sanctioned events we have per year compared to the other tournaments. They're like playing like 25 tournaments in 1 week, basically, on a... So that's the main benefit of winning, is to get into those co-sanctions for the guys on the Sunshine Tour. So yeah, it's quite hard that, you know, if you do mess it up, then it's like, oh, I've got a pre-queue again for, you know, SA Open and tournament in Mauritius and Joburg Open and Dunhill. And so yeah, that's the main pressure was getting an exemption rather than sort of the prize money and stuff.
Yeah, you recently then had YouTuber James Wilshere, who was caddying for you for a few weeks on the Sunshine Tour and the co-sanctioned events. Anyone who doesn't know James Wilshere, yeah, he's a YouTuber, but he's also does golf lessons. He's a professional. He's a pro. He's a golf pro. Golf pro. He's also then, he's very good videos. Watch them. And he had Steve on a lot the last few weeks. And how did our relationship come about? How do you know James?
I started playing a few events with James. He filmed some stuff at Cumberwell, actually, at my home club. And then he started playing some Tremigo events, so I got to know him through that. And then we did like a course vlog with him, and then sort of got mates. And so I sort of said to him, well, if you're not doing anything in the winter, do you want to come to South Africa? Because I think the UK was on lockdown then. So he obviously couldn't film any content back home. So I sort of said, well, do you want to come and caddy? You can film some content, etc. You know, he'd never been to South Africa. And that's how he ended up sort of caddying, really.
How did he compare to a professional caddy?
No, he's good. He did a good job, James, yeah. It's nice to have sort of a friend on the bag that you can just chat to, and, you know, rather than... Sometimes if you had a caddy and they try and get too involved, and I'm quite self-sufficient, so I don't really need too much help or too much input. Whereas if you've got a caddy that is trying to give you a lot of input and stuff, sometimes for me, I can sort of get out of my way and let me do my own thing, and I'll ask when I need a bit of help. So he's really good, and we had a good sort of 3 weeks together.
Definitely, well, watch the videos; they were brilliant to follow and see the behind the scenes and stuff. What kind of, as someone who doesn't, and a lot of people listening to this won't have ever had a caddy or understand what caddies do, is there something that kind of shocked James in one of the requirements to being a caddy that he wasn't expecting?
Probably how heavy the bag was. He didn't like that, and how hot it was.
He's a big lad, James, as well. That bag should have been nothing to James.
But he moaned about it every day, bless him. I think it was quite good for him to see. Like, we played with quite a few decent players over the 3 weeks. And I think it helped him seeing what those, say, like a 70th to 150th player in the world, what they do, how they manage the game, how they prepare, etc. Sort of James's background was, used to be a golf pro, but still is a golf pro, but then went into personal training, then did some YouTubing, some long drive, etc. So he's never really, but now he wants to concentrate on sort of the tournament side of golf. So I think for him, it was really good to see what guys do, how their games compare, and like his perception of what they do was, by the end of the week, quite a lot different than what it was at the sort of start of the trip. But yeah, like I say, I think I'm quite easy to caddy for, because I'm quite self-sufficient. So
yeah, just look at Steve. If you ever need someone, give me a shout.
You're in,
and I'll be straight over. Yeah. You have played in a major in your career, the Open in 2007 at Turnberry, which is obviously infamous to us Irish golf fans, as Padraig Harrington won that in the playoff against Sergio Garcia. That obviously had to be an amazing moment for you, playing in an Open, a major, especially the Open, the British Open. Can you explain to us what that experience was like?
For me at the time, it was a bit surreal, really, because I hadn't played a European Tour event at that point. So me and my friend Harry Bird, who was caddying for me at the time, he now caddies on the main tour, sort of did Open qualifying, and I started terribly, and 36 holes in one day, I think. Can't remember now, but like, I remember not starting very well, and then by the end of it, sort of had a 5 foot putt on the last green. I thought, right, this is like getting to the Open, and I hold it luckily, and I think I got in by a couple in the end. But sort of the last few holes were just horrible, because it was out of bounds all at the right, and I think it's a qualifying. If you miss by a shot or you miss by 20 shots, it makes no difference. You're not playing. I remember the qualifying being quite nervous, and then the experience of the Open was brilliant. I sort of not played a tour event, and the size of it all, and learning, trying to find out where the driving range was on the first day, because they don't use the normal driving range, they have to use one of the holes on the other golf course because there's so much infrastructure. And I mean, it's a brilliant experience. I'd love to play one again, because I think obviously now I'd sort of cope with it a lot better. I mean, I had a good first round. I think I shot 69. It was probably 25th or 30th or something after the first round. So it was nice to get the good experience of having a good round. And then the second day, I struggled a little bit off the tee into the wind, kept hitting in the rough, hacking out, and then hitting a 5-iron in or an 8-iron in for your third shot. And the last few holes, I just hated when I knew I'd missed the cut. It was weird, because I just wanted to get off the golf course, because I think I'd had, say, 33, 31 holes of like quite a high, well, 18 holes real high, playing well, and then struggling a bit, but I still got a chance to make the cut. And then when I knew I was missing the cut, I was like, as much as I wanted to really enjoy it, because I was like, I would have dreamt of playing in an Open as a 13-year-old lad or whatever. I was like, I just could not wait to get off the golf course. And it was quite a, it was probably a real crappy experience in the end. Like, just only the last 4 or 5 holes of playing in something that outside people think how lucky you are. Whereas at that time, I chatted to one of my friends about it, and he did the same, but he had a bad start in his first round. And he said, oh, after 7 or 8 holes, he's like, I knew I missed the cut. And he's like, I just wanted to get off the golf course, even though he'd spent the previous 30 years or, whatever, dreaming of playing in an Open. So it's quite strange, the emotions that you go through that people on the outside probably don't think you're going through. Probably still think, oh, you're still playing the Open. It must be amazing. Whereas if you're out there not playing well, it's not a lot of fun.
Had you played Turnberry before, or was that your first experience?
I had played it in a junior tournament years ago, but I couldn't really remember the course that well. Bar is really nice. But yeah, no, it's a great track. I mean, probably, if I had a choice, I'd probably love to play one at St. Andrews, because I think that's obviously the place to play an Open. But no, the whole experience I absolutely loved. I mean, it's a bit of a nightmare getting accommodation and stuff around Turnberry. Because obviously the prices are sky high, and I remember sort of rang up the RNA and asked if they withhold any accommodation for qualifiers, sort of thinking, oh, they might subsidise a room at a travel lodge or something. But we do, it's at the Turnberry Hotel, and I think it was £780 a night, minimum stay 10 nights.
Jesus Christ.
Yeah, I've not quite got the budget for that, to be honest.
Yeah. So minimum stay 10 nights?
I think it was, yeah.
Sure, the tournament's only, you know, 4 days.
Yeah, no, I think they obviously try and get the guys to come in early, sort of for the guys that want to come in the Monday or Tuesday or Wednesday the week before or whatever. But yeah, I remember looking at it thinking, no, that's not an option.
No. And where did you end up staying?
I got lucky. The guy that sorts out all the IT Cumberwell, my home golf club, he was working at the Players Golf Club in Bristol, and I think he overheard someone saying, oh, someone's got accommodation for the Open, if you know anyone that's going. So we ended up booking that because it's quite cheap. But yeah, it was about half an hour away from the golf course, I think. But yeah, I mean, so, some of my other mates end up staying in caravans and stuff when they're playing the Open, just because it's all they can afford, because it's obviously stupid money for anywhere half decent.
It's all right for the Rory McIlroys of the world, I'm sure, but Jesus, yeah. that's mad. I want to talk about your demeanour on the course, Steve, because from what I've seen anyway, you seem very laid back and very chilled, and you don't let a lot get to you. And has that always been your kind of mindset on the course, or did you have to work on something like that? Like, do you ever lose your cool?
No, I tend to sulk rather than have a head off. But no, I'm generally pretty chilled. I always have been on the course, and you know, yeah, I get angry and frustrated, but I try not to let it bubble over too much. Or, I mean, I don't think if I'm proper mad, then I might have a little head off for 5 minutes. But try and sort of get on with it and take it for what it is. You know, you're trying your best, and you're just not playing very well. So I've always been quite lucky in that regard, I suppose, with temperament, and not that I think there's anything wrong. You've got to do whatever's best for you. You know, as a pro's point of view, if you're absolutely fuming, there's no point in not having a head off and getting rid of that, and then spending 2.5 hours super frustrated but trying to keep that frustration in. Sometimes you're better off letting it go for like 2 minutes, and then by the time you get to your next shot, you're totally fine. But yeah, I've always been pretty relaxed, really.
Yeah, I think it comes across definitely when watching you play. You know, even when you won that tournament, there was no massive celebration.
I was just relieved I didn't make 10, that was why.
Yeah, exactly. When you tap that putt in for 9 on the last, you looked fairly relieved. Again, in one of the videos with Jim Wilshere, again, you were giving advice not to overcomplicate the game, because he was trying, I think at the time, he was trying to hit like maybe a low power fade, and you know, then next shot he'd be hitting a high draw. And you were kind of saying there's no need to do that, because your miss gets a lot bigger then if you're trying to, you know, 3 different swings at once. I think you actually said if you go out and actually bore yourself to death, you will shoot a lower score than if you don't, which I thought was a great quote. Can you expand on that kind of thought process? Obviously, do you see a lot of amateurs that try and overcomplicate the game?
Yeah, well, what I mainly say with amateurs is see them. If you cut the ball 30 yards and you cut the ball 30 yards pretty consistently, they want to get rid of that area of the game and try and, oh, I'd love to be able to draw the ball, or you know, or vice versa, if you draw the ball, you'd love to be able to fade it, etc. Whereas, so although you might not do it in the way you want to do it, if you have control over it and you know, right, I can aim this 20 yards into the left rough and it's going to cut back somewhere near the fairway, it's like, well, you have control over your golf ball then. So rather than trying to constantly fight what you've already got, sort of embrace what you've already got a little bit and just maybe try and minimize it a little bit more. But everyone always wants to do the opposite of what they can do. And then I think you get down to the next level, sort of say the five to scratch golfers, you know, like lots of those guys think tour pros are hitting a cut to a back right pin, a draw to a left hand pin, you know, a low running shot to a back pin, a high shot to the front pin. And I'm like, it's not really a tool. You might get a Tiger Woods that's good enough to do that because, you know, he's an absolute joke. But it's like 99% of the other guys on tour generally play in one sort of shape near enough. They might occasionally try and hit it in the other direction, but it's always not trying to hit the most impressive shot, try and hit the shot you can control the most. And but also the control is, say, for the sort of the normal amateur golfer, it's like, well, if you know the ball's going to go to left or right, then you have some form of control over it already. Like, you don't have to try and totally work to try and hit draws, because that's what you want to do. Because trust me, when you're, if you're hitting it the other way, if you're hitting it 30 yards right to left, you would love to be able to hit like a little soft cut shot. So sort of embrace what you've got a bit, I suppose, is what I would say.
Yeah, and on that point then, I think looking back to, say, Padraig Harrington, who won, you know, three majors in the space of a year and a half, do you feel like he possibly went down that route of trying to overcomplicate it instead of embracing what he had?
I think he's a bit of a difficult one, because I would say, yes, he probably did overcomplicate it. But it's also the overcomplicating it that got him to win those three majors, if that makes sense, because he's always been, well, not that I know him very well, but like from following his career, he's always been quite keen in trying new stuff, going down new avenues. And I mean, that is what got him to win the three majors and have an unbelievable 3 years, was it, when he won three majors, I think, or 2 years?
Yeah, he won them in a year and a half. He won two Opens in a row on a PGA.
PGA, yeah, yeah.
18 months.
Yeah.
Like, it was incredible.
But then when your form dips off, then it's quite easy to pick holes and say, oh, you should have just stuck with what you were doing. Whereas, well, I have stuck with what I was doing because I was constantly searching, and that's what got you to the point of winning those three majors. So he carried on doing the same thing, I guess. Whereas, yeah, you can look back and say, well, just carry on doing what you're doing at that exact time. But it wasn't that exact time that produced those performances. It was all the years of work before, of trying different things and going down different avenues and finding things that work and don't work, that resulted in that little 18 months of like unbelievable golf, if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, 100%. And is there any other, one of the last questions I have for you, any other players in the world that you look at, and do you think that if they made one change, maybe whether it be swing or mental, like, for example, I'm a massive Rory McIlroy fan, and I think that if he, a bit like you said there, if he just got out of his frustration in 2 minutes, rather than, I think he's a bit of a sulker over maybe six holes instead of, you know, a big blowout, and he's fine. Like, he lets bad shots get to him a lot. Do you think there's any other player like that, that, you know, you look at a Tyrrell Hatton, who tends to actually, it's a blowout, but it's over, and then he's back to playing good stuff. Do you think there's other players that should benefit from that or could benefit from that?
Yeah, I mean, I think you've got to do a little bit of, I was reading something like Justin Rose the other day on Dustin Johnson, you know, and I think he said they were playing Riviera somewhere, and DJ sort of duck hooked it out of bounds, so teed up another one, walking down the fairway, and Justin Rose opened the sandwich, you know, Dustin Johnson just sort of said to himself, oh, like, Rosie, what have you got in your sandwich? You know, Justin Rose's like, yeah, jam or whatever. He's like, mate, you've just duck hooked it out of bounds, like, you should be fuming. But that's who he is, if you know what I mean. Whereas, say, Tyrrell Hatton seems to try and be reining slightly who he is, but also keep a little bit of... I think he'll end up being quite funny and really liked, because I think he's quite happy to take the mick out of himself afterwards. But he's also quite true to sort of who he is, and he's quite comfortable in being himself. Whereas I think if you're constantly not trying to be yourself, that's also quite tiring and quite hard work, and yeah, takes away your concentration from your golf, because it's, you're actually trying to be a fake person for 4 hours whilst playing golf for 5 hours. So yeah, I'm trying to think. I can't think of anyone. Yeah, I can't think of any players that would instantly benefit from. I think most of them are very good at being themselves generally, and say with Rory, I don't know if he used to have a little bit of a temperament or not. I mean, he's launched a few clubs into the lakes and stuff, but I think it must be so hard for someone like that where you've got all this sponsorship and all this image to look after that can sometimes probably be a bit detrimental to your results, because if Rory snaps a club over his knee, you know, it's all over YouTube, all over Sky Sports, all over... Whereas that could be him trying to be a better golfer because he's just getting rid of his anger, whereas then you get absolutely slaughtered for it on social media, etc.
Even when Rory throws the club into the water, his angles are still always perfect, and yeah, it's like an incredible release, and it's just so frustrating.
Yeah, I think it's only Sergio that probably had a better release when he launched.
Yes, yeah, even Sergio, it was so flat. It was incredible. Last question I have for you, Steve. I had Ronan Mullarney on, who's an Irish pro from Galway here a few months ago. He's in his early 20s and only starting his career. You've been a pro since 2003, and I want to kind of ask your opinion, like, how much has golf changed from when you started first to now? Like, what's changed in your game the most that may be surprising to people?
What's changed the most? Probably the biggest change has probably been... I mean, I've been taught to hit the ball a long way would be the biggest for me. You know, I remember when I was starting, I was told to swing it smooth. Like, you know, if you jumped off the ground, you were told, no, you've got to have stable footwork. You got to have a smooth tempo. You can't hit it hard. I was like, no, that's the polar opposite of what you're being taught now. It is to jump out the ground, hit it as hard as you can, learn to hit it straight after. And yeah, I think you're starting to see that sort of, say, on the mini tours and the college stuff in America, some of the guys, sort of, especially in America, hit it miles, because that's such a big skill set now. Whereas, yeah, when I started, I remember like Anton Hague hit it a long way. There was like Ernie was long. Sort of, there wasn't many good youngsters that hit it miles, whereas now every good youngster hits it miles because it's such a big skill set for golf.
Yeah, do you like that it's gone that way? Or
no, I hate it because I can't hit it very far.
Well, the journey's still on, Steve. You can still get to that 180.
Yeah, oh, yeah, maybe. Yeah, I've done about 180. No, yeah, I think I probably preferred golf in like late 90s. Slightly different equipment, slightly different ball, slightly... I mean, but that with that equipment and stuff, the game still might have changed just through the technology and recording the stats and stuff, being able to show that if you do hit the golf ball further, it is actually that much easier than... I mean, we were taught, you know, try and hit a 20-yard cut with a 6-iron to a back right pin. It's like, it's actually useless. Yeah, we're doing better off being told to hit the ball as hard as you can and sort of give up a bit of control and just hit the thing a long way. But yeah, I suppose that's probably going to be the biggest thing, I think, in the next few years. Guys, you'll probably see like a Happy Gilmore driver swing. I think guys will have their own swing for a driver and then swing all the other golf clubs differently.
Oh yeah, that's actually a good point. I never thought about that.
That's what I think. I know Harrington was doing it for a little while, wasn't he, in practice and stuff.
Practice, yeah. He was also swinging from his knees, wasn't he, I think, at some stage as well. So
Yeah,
I think he could be the first one. He could be the pioneer for that, maybe, yeah.
Yeah, I think that's what guys do, is have a totally different driver swing and then swing the rest of the golf clubs quite normal.
I'm looking forward to that era of golf. Steve, we'll finish on that. Thank you very much for joining us. What's your plans? What's your schedule like for the next month so that we can follow along and support you?
I'm flying to South Africa on Monday, and then I've got 4 events in a row in Johannesburg, and then 2 weeks off, and then hopefully 3 Challenge Tour events in South Africa if they're still on with sort of the COVID travelling situation. But yeah, worst case scenario, I've got a month of golf coming up. So
happy days. Well, we wish you the best of luck and look forward to following you and cheering you on from here in Ireland. And thank you again for giving up your time, and we'll see you soon.
Perfect. Thank you for having me.
No worries. Cheers, thank you.